Greetings, it's me, Alexa from the future. I want to dedicate this episode to the memory of Eli from Unearthing Paranormalcy. This is a poem called The Journey Home. You'll climb over that range with cloud-shrouded peaks, valleys deep and misty. Beyond, you'll see the sky dips low, soft curtains of steam rolling over waters. You'll wrap yourself up in velvet weightlessness, winds dancing songs through trickling tides, unfolding night until light sends the stars scattering. When you find yourself at the peak of the climb, call back to us. Let your laughter roll through the lands, a distant thunder, and through our hearts, an indefinite song. On behalf of me and everybody at the Green Mushroom Podcast Network, to the folks over at Unearthing Paranormalcy and their families, much love.
Lux Occult is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. That is Isaiah 14, 12 through 14 from the King James Version of the Bible. Hello and welcome to Lux Occult. This is the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult topics. I'm your host, Lux Estrada, and if you're hearing the sound of my voice, that means that this show, and magic for that matter, are for you if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice in your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anybody but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree sometimes. How will we ever learn anything if we all agreed all the time after all? And like those who attempt to be reasonable should be willing to do, I am willing to revise my opinions based on new evidence. All right, I'm very excited to bring you today's very interesting conversation with Esoteric Eddie, the author of the book The Lucifer Mystery Revealed. It was a great time hanging out and chatting with him about many topics, such as the history and origin of the name Lucifer, and how the name might have gotten into the Bible. We also hit on Zoroastrianism and hear a little bit about Saint Lucifer. And we're also going to hear about how doing this research kind of changed my guest's perspective on things. And these stories about personal transformation are typically pretty interesting, and so I really appreciate Eddie being willing to come on and share his thoughts and research with me and all of you. There's also going to be a special episode within the episode today featuring the very badass Rachel, who is working on a really cool project involving Steel Mace Flow, the Green Mushroom Project, and more. Stoked to get to that too. Before I get any further though, I would like to say thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate that you have taken the time to hang out with me here on this show. I'm super lucky to have such amazing listeners and collaborators, etc. You all definitely are the best. I've made a conscious choice to use social media a lot less lately. There's been a lot of studies that indicate there's a direct inverse correlation between the time that you spend on it and your personal life satisfaction. I do think that that has played out for me. Anyway, but that doesn't mean that I don't want to hear from all of you. I always welcome people's thoughts, questions, comments, suggestions, or arcane revelations. You can reach out to me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at luxoccultpod. If you're into the show and you're into what I'm doing, you can support it on Patreon. And if you decide to do that, you will be able to take a bibliomancy break with me. And there are no tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. And to all of you who are already doing that, thank you so much. Your support really means a lot and it makes the show possible. So I really appreciate it. Thank you. And I've said this before, I think like I actually just did, but I will say it again, the people who listen to this are the fucking coolest, case in point. Thank you so much to Adele for the very rad gifts. I love all of what you sent me, very dope stuff. I've been experimenting with listening to the 156 album, Memento Mori, which is played using human bones, for some meditative work, and I've really been enjoying it. So I appreciate you thinking of me, thank you. I'm hoping that we can have a conversation about all this stuff in the not too distant future. All right, during the interview, Eddie mentions learning from failure, which is a topic that I will return to after our chat. We're also going to touch base with the thought experiment that was featured in the last episode of the show regarding Mary and Mary's black and white room. And that was chapter 2 of the Green Mushroom Project audio grimoire, where you can find that. I've gotten some cool feedback regarding the thought experiment that was covered in that one and the concept of qualia. Shout out to those of you who commented about this stuff, and thank you so much to BJ for the kind words and for sharing an example of what might be considered strong evidence in favor of qualia. More on that later. And since people liked the thought experiment in the last one, I will present you with another. Today will be a classic one from philosopher Robert Nozick, which I think ties in really well with the question that Eddie asks me during the bibliomancy break, so we're going to do that right before then. I'm also going to tell you about a very cool short video made by a listener inspired by the Green Mushroom Project. Really stoked to share that as well. All right. I'll be back during breaks to say what's up and to do all that stuff I just mentioned, as well as read you a bit of poetry, do more shoutouts, and make some announcements, and also to introduce my conversation with the badass Rachel. As I mentioned, there's going to be a fun surprise after the interview, but I don't want to spoil it now, so stay tuned for all of that. All right, I think I've hyped this all enough. I feel stoked. Are you stoked? I hope so. Let's get into it. Here is my conversation with Esoteric Eddie. All right. Well, my guest today is Eduardo Fidencio Cano, aka Esoteric Eddie, who is the author of The Lucifer Mystery Revealed. So how are you doing, dude?
I'm good. Just chilling, relaxing. It's a nice sunny Monday over here in San Diego.
Fuck yeah. Yeah.
Just kicking back.
So I'm super excited to talk about this book and some of the like background. So for, you know, people that aren't familiar with your work or you, or you know, like, could you go ahead and introduce yourself and just give us like a little bit of idea of, you know, what you're up to, what you're into and all that?
Yes, absolutely. So my name is Eddie, Esoteric Eddie. I'm 27 years old as of right now, and I've been studying the occult, the esoteric, the conspiratorial for well over 10 years now. My whole life has really revolved around the esoteric. I grew up in a religious family, both Christian and Catholic. And so early on, I was influenced by the Bible. I myself was never like indoctrinated in the sense, for example, I hated going to church. I never liked that part of it, but something about the Bible and the stories and the knowledge just stupefied me, and I was intrigued by it. And all throughout my life, I'd have little random instances that would, you know, show me that there was much more going on. For example, when I was in middle school, there was an assistant teacher who was all the kids liked him. He was cool. He was an interesting dude. He was an Irish dude. And he would kind of give us the free will to make our own choices. And But long story short, I found out that he was a Freemason, and he always had this really fat, like, Freemason ring. And he told me the story one time when I was in Saturday school of how he got it. And so early on, I was kind of learning these random things about secret societies and how the Bible and religion in general has so much more to it. And then right around 12 to 14, I got into psychedelics. I got into underground hip hop, and I was always into rock and roll. So even in elementary, you know, listening to Hendrix and Pink Floyd, I kind of had like an anti-government attitude about me. But when I got into psychedelics and hip hop and started actually researching and reading and watching documentaries around 12 to 14, that's when it really took off for me. So from 12 to now, I've done a lot of different things in the world, but as an artist and as a scholar, I've written different essays, and I did publish a book before around 2018 that was, in my mind, an industry failure. Took that down. I'm actually revamping that one right now. And I have produced documentaries and videos in the past, which were a success for the time being, but later proved to be industry failures. For example, I had a video up on YouTube years ago in 2018 that was on the Illuminati's history, and that was taken down. They took it down after like 10,000 views. But nonetheless, all throughout my life, I've been researching this stuff and trying to understand it and trying to also formulate how I wanted to become a professional and present this knowledge and educate the people. So Esoteric Eddie is the new form of my artistry. I just launched Esoteric Eddie TV on YouTube and just published my book all around my new book, The Lucifer Mystery Revealed, all around the same time, which was last December. But both of those projects were a culmination of 2 years. I started writing the book around 25 years old, which was right around the start of the pandemic. So, yeah, everything, my whole life has kind of revolved around this and being an artist with different backgrounds in like graphic design and video production and music production and just being a writer as well. I decided, you know, and all the failures that I've had, because I've had many failures up to this point, I kind of took everything that I've been through, all that I've experienced, and said, you know what, let's take another shot at this. And that's what my more recent escapades through Esoteric Eddie have been.
Okay, that's dope, dude. Like, hell yeah. I'm kind of curious. So you were talking about like this idea of like an industry, and this is a little bit off topic, but I'm curious. Yeah. Like, so you're talking about this idea of like an industry failure or an industry success. Like, I'm a little bit unfamiliar with like those contexts. Could you tell me like why you feel that way, or like what, like maybe like why it didn't hit the mark, or I'm just a little bit confused and curious.
Sure. So I'm fascinated by people's success stories. You know, I study musicians, I study artists, all kinds of things. I just love learning in general. And I grew up as a music artist. My first alias or my first project as an artist was actually a musician, a hip hop artist. And I had some success locally. I got into that in high school and had a lot of success locally. I would help organize events. I've performed some big shows. But I kind of just stopped doing that over the years because I realized it's not who I wanted to be or what I really wanted to do. Even my music centered around esoteric and occult subjects. But when I say I had industry failures, for example, I wrote my first book and I published my first book in 2018. And I was eager. I was about 22, 23 around that time. I was eager and I kind of just was like ranting throughout most of the book. And I never, it was cringy. It's cringy for me to read. And I never had it professionally edited. So I kind of just edited it myself. And I put it out there and I got some good feedback, but the more honest feedback was that it was just bad. It was just bad. So,
okay, well, I mean, I think that at least there is something to be said for the fact that you just like did it, though. Like a lot of people would be so worried that it's not going to be good enough that they would like never make it. So I think that we learn so much from our failures, right? Like that's how we learn. So I think it's dope that you're just like, well, here you go. Here's my rantings, yeah. Right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you hear it all the time, right? And like these motivational memes or videos, it's like you got to fail, you know, you got to go through those failures. And it was a personal success. I still count it as my first book and my first shot at the world.
Heck yeah.
When you study people as I have, you find that they've had these very interesting failures, but it's only the successes that we are familiar with.
Oh yeah, definitely. That is a very good point.
Yeah, so I'm kind of glad that I had that. I went through that, you know, that harsh critiquing and that failure. And when I wrote The Lucifer Mystery Revealed, I decided to not make those same mistakes. So I put a lot of time and effort into writing this as professionally as I could from my point of view, and then also, you know, paying out of pocket, you know, decent money to have somebody professionally edit it and review it before giving it to the world.
Sure. Oh yeah. So I'm kind of curious, like with your interest in conspiracy thought and conspiracy theories and stuff, how have you navigated the like, 'cause I know that there can be some pretty unseemly like elements to a lot of the communities that surround some of that stuff. I don't want to get too specific because there's like so very many examples that we could give, but like I'm just kind of curious, like as somebody who is into that stuff, like what advice would you give to people in terms of like staying away from like really sort of like dubious things that are definitely like no good and lead people to do weird shit or whatever?
I see what you're saying. Okay, we'll just give you a little like personal experience stories. Like to begin with, when I first started reading this stuff back in like late middle school, early high school, as a young kid, it was like fascinating and freaked me out. You know, like I was watching David Icke videos in like ninth grade when he's like talking about reptilians and shape-shifting
Yeah, yes.
politicians.
In the height of his power.
Yes. So being like a stoner kid, like that was just awesome, you know, like no way, like it was just fun. And I was like freaking out, and I would actually go to school and like kind of preach this stuff. I used to, me and my other friend, we'd sit down and we'd get sticky notes. We'd steal sticky notes from like our teacher's desk, and we just write endlessly on these sticky notes, like research David Icke, research reptilians, research Planet X, like all these little different things, and we'd go stick them everywhere. You know, so I went through that phase of being like a fanatic of the conspiracy theories. But as I grew and matured and started to look at the world through a realistic, centered perspective, I started to focus on things that actually matter. You know, I realized if reptilians are real, I mean, it doesn't really make a difference to the day in and day out operations that we need to focus on to live good and healthy lives for ourselves and for our families and for our communities. So I guess my answer to your question would be, it's okay, you know, to look into things, to look into conspiracies that are out there and psychedelic on a personal level. But I think that as a community, we shouldn't be focusing on things that aren't necessary to create impactful and healthy lifestyles in the now.
That's a very good way of looking at it. Fuck yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so you indicate in the beginning of your book, The Lucifer Mystery Revealed, that really doing this research and like kind of going down this, I don't, maybe rabbit hole was a sort of like transformative process for you. And I was hoping that we could get a little bit of behind the scenes view of it before we actually dive into some of the topics that you write about.
Yes, absolutely. So, growing up in a religious family, there was a time in my life when I was a young person that I wholly believed that, you know, the devil was real in the way that Christianity portrays it. And I believed that demons were real, again, in the way Christianity, you know, perceives it. And so, growing up, I was just ignorant of Lucifer and the devil, and I just figured that they were both the same being. I was like, well, Lucifer was Satan, you know, before he became Satan, and that's kind of the way that the church proposes it. And then later on, as I started learning more about ancient cultures and the origins of religions and the origins of certain of some of these concepts, and particularly when I got into the study of the Anunnaki through the works of Zechariah Sitchin, it was him and his works that made me realize that the figure of Lucifer is actually based on Enki, the Sumerian god. So before I wrote the Lucifer Mystery Revealed, I personally already knew who Lucifer was, but I kind of wanted to set out and collect all the evidence and background story to present that to the rest of the world. But to my surprise, when I started studying Lucifer, the etymology, the history of the concept within the church and the occult, I started to learn a whole lot more other things that I never even knew were out there. So it was just eye-opening and really cool to learn all these other different things that played a part.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, let's get into it with some of these. I feel like the book is full of a cast of colorful characters, you know? We've got all kinds of interesting folks here. But maybe we should start out where you started out and just talk a little bit about the name Lucifer. Do you want to comment about like what you discovered when you started digging into that?
Yes, absolutely. So that's kind of my writing style, is I kind of always start with a question. And the question I had for myself in the book was, how did we first hear of the name Lucifer? Like, when did that first occur in history? And what I found was that the name Lucifer, as we know it, was introduced to the world primarily through the King James's Bible, the official authorized English version from the 1600s. And in that version, the first official English version, Lucifer was used only once. And it was used in the famous Isaiah 14:12 verse, which is the one that goes, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning," etc. But the interesting thing is that it's actually a translational error. And because in the English version, it's used as an uppercase noun or name. But the English was translated from the Latin, and the Latin was translated from the Greek, which was all translated from the Hebrew. And in the Latin is where we first see the word Lucifer, because Lucifer is a Latin word comprising of two root words, lucius, light, and ferre, which means to bring or to bear, which is where we get the occult concept of Lucifer being the light bearer. But in the Latin version, the Latin Vulgate, which the Roman Catholic Church used, Lucifer was used multiple times, and it was used as an adjective, a lowercase word. Now, the Latin Vulgate was translated from the Greek Septuagint. In the Greek, where we would see Lucifer today, we would see the word phosphorus, which is the equivalent of the Latin word Lucifer. It's something bright, and also to bring, you know, the light bearer, something that's bright or bringing light. And all of them come from the original Hebrew Old Testament, because Isaiah comes from the Old Testament. And then where we would see Lucifer today in the Old Testament, Hebrew Old Testament, we would see the term Hallel ben Shahar. And Hallel ben Shahar is loosely translated as Hallel, meaning something shite, bright. I was going to say shiny and bright. Some shite, something shiny.
Shiny and bright, shite.
Shite. Oh, whole new meaning to the word now, huh? No, but so Hallel is something bright. Kind of like, it's kind of also comes from the same root word as hallelujah, you know, like hallel, hallelujah. So something bright. And then ben is of course the Hebrew word for son. So Hallel ben Shahar is you know, Hallel, the son of Shahar. And Shahar in Hebrew also means dawn. So that's where we get the Lucifer, son of the morning. Now, what makes it all the more interesting is that Hallel, phosphorus, and the Latin Lucifer are also all words that can also be used to represent Venus. And Venus, as we know, in its celestial mythology.
And we're talking planet Venus here. Or are we talking about the goddess as well?
Well, both. But primarily in its planetary representation. I mean, just in the skies itself, Venus is the brightest celestial object before the sun rises. So Hallel, Phosphorus, and Lucifer, yes, they mean something bright, But they are also representing Venus, because Venus is the brightest celestial object, which precedes the sun every single morning. And I'll stop there before we go any further. But any questions or comments?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'm glad that you brought up Venus, because I was hoping that we could talk a little bit more about that. So that this is perfect.
Yes, absolutely. So Venus in ancient times was highly, highly respected for various reasons. For example, and this isn't in the book, but for example, like the Mayans went through great lengths to study Venus's astronomical movements in the sky. And Venus is just has always played a huge role in ancient cosmology and astronomy for various reasons. And there's one reason that I stumbled upon after writing the book, which I kind of regret. I wish I would have stumbled upon this before, but not sure if you're familiar with Velikovsky. Are you familiar with Velikovsky and his work? So Immanuel Velikovsky was a Russian, Israeli, and American scholar, but he was mostly famous for kind of writings, some of his writings, for example, Worlds in Collision. And in most of his works, what he does is he re-examines the solar system and re-examines ancient astronomy. And he proposed an idea that our solar system wasn't always as uniform as it is today. And as a matter of fact, it was chaotic and erratic and not that much long ago, like very, very recent in our history. And he concluded that Venus was revered by so many different cultures because Venus had such an erratic orbit in the past, and that whenever it would come close to us, it would cause major destruction. So it was very important for the ancient astronomer priests all throughout the world to observe Venus and keep a close eye on it, because if she was coming close, it just meant destruction.
Interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of astronomers in his day, which was basically the 20th century, they were kind of like, they were talking down on his works pretty much. They thought he was kind of like,
it sounds pretty out there, but yeah, it's yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. He was a pioneer, you know, in his, in his works. But yes, Venus has been regarded, with so much respect all throughout time. And in the book, I go into how, Hillel Ben Shahar, is actually a representation of an old Canaanite deity by the name of Astar, who was a reimagined male version of an even more ancient Astarte and Ishtar, who are also ancient old world deities. She was a goddess who was represented by the planet or star Venus, and her symbol, the seven-pointed star, goes all the way back to the Sumerian Inanna, and who was a fierce warrior goddess. And she was always depicted and written about as being like this lustful, like beautiful goddess, but who was also very, you know, feisty and warlike.
Yeah, she's also like a love goddess and a fertility goddess, but also like a goddess of like political power and of like taking over other people's like land and shit and like, right? Like yeah. Conquest and like interesting stuff.
Yeah, in her representation as Inanna, which is probably the most ancient representation, the Sumerian one. Yeah, there's all kinds of writings of her wanting to usurp the throne or pretty much demanding from the other gods that, you know, she'd be given certain lands or certain weapons or technology. She was actually, I believe, a great-granddaughter of the head of the Sumerian pantheon.
I think it's so interesting, just sort of like stepping away from everything for just like a second and taking a little bit of like a meta perspective. It's kind of interesting how, but it sounds like, you know, somebody that they want to usurp power, they're like, they're not happy with their place. And that's the same story that we have in, you know, in our modern contextualization of Lucifer, right? Like Lucifer wasn't cool with being the prettiest angel. He wanted to, you know, dethrone God and become God, right? Like, so it's kind of interesting that like even, how we see these like strange like rhyming themes reemerging over history.
Yeah. And it's interesting how like that, you know, anthropomorphic aspect coincides with what Velikovsky was saying about Venus being this erratic and chaotic planet that could come close to Earth and cause major destruction.
Sure. Yeah, this idea of Velikovsky's that things in the solar system were much more erratic in the near past is a really fascinating one.
Yeah.
Greetings. It is I, Luxa from the future. Thank you for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We're going to be getting into a thought experiment, which is related to the bibliomancy break in a bit. But first, I wanted to hop in and read you a little thematically appropriate poetry and share about the friendship meditation video made by Jay. So earlier on, Eddie mentioned that he used to be into conspiracy stuff, and I wanted to let everybody know that I had a great conversation with Dr. Rob C. Thompson from over at the Occult Confessions podcast about conspiracy thought and how occultism sometimes gets mixed up in it. Shout out to Rob and the Alchemical Actors, very cool stuff over there. So that episode is number 27. And check it out if you want to take a bite out of the conspiracy burger. Also, check it out if you want that weird thing I just said to make sense about the burger. Anyway, as I said, I found a little bit of thematically appropriate poetry, which I wanted to share with you all here. So this is a poem called Lucifer by Carol Muesky. 2 a.m. and we're on Lucifer. Arguing, drinking. One of us is a believer. I say if that beautiful, light-named angel, once most loved to God, fell, he must have kept falling into insight, scattering his illumination, plummeting, coming apart. Into a broken new deity, one that divides, as the woman's face in darkness, the man's face in quick, ripped slashes of light. Starry dark, down and down, she falls into her empty glass. The night sky lights up with all he refuses to let go. All right, fuck yeah. So that was originally published in the American Poetry Review. There's a link to that in the show notes. All right, so as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to tell you about a very cool short video that a participant of the Green Mushroom Project has made. All right, he wishes to credit the Green Mushroom Project for the inspiration of what he calls his first magical love child video, Friendship Meditation, and has included these instructions for working with the creation. So links to the video and what I'm about to read you will also be in the show notes. Okay, so here is what you can do. Step one, write out what friendship is to you, or maybe what you feel it ought to be. Step two, read it over and freely edit your thoughts until you feel a sense of completion with your definition. There is a natural hope already within us that this definition will translate into intent. All right, step three, read your thoughts until you feel the satisfaction of the definition. Step four, relax, watch, and listen to the video, and you can feel the absorption into your being, and these ideas will begin to manifest within you and around you. Happy manifestation. Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This is very cool stuff. In a communication with me, he has contextualized the creation as a child, like a love child, actually, as I said a second ago, who wishes to explore a reflective journey of thought and play around, and you know, who will be happy sort of like wandering around and meeting new people. So I kind of love that. Like, I'm very here for thinking about it like that. I also really like the practice of contemplating what words and concepts mean. I think we can learn so much about how we think by examining things like etymology. There's like all this unseen infrastructure behind things. Like something as simple as a word like friendship has infinite number of moving parts. I sometimes think of all this stuff as like, I don't know, a big machine or something, a really complicated one. If we could just find a schematic for it. Anyway, I feel like I'm getting into the weeds here. The point is that I love this creation, and if you decide to work with it, let me know what your impressions are. My interaction with it made me feel a lot of gratitude about how cool all of you are, actually. So much love. I'm very lucky to be doing what I'm doing, and it's all of you who make it possible. So thank you. All right, well, enough of the mush. I will be back soon to talk about the thought experiment and all of that. But let's get back into it. Here is more of my chat with Esoteric Eddie. So, marching forward in history, sort of, with this name, you mentioned that there is somebody called Saint Lucifer. Can we talk a little bit about Saint Lucifer?
Yes. All right. So, of course, Lucifer was just a Latin word or name, you know, so it was actually an endearing name in the past, sort of like, I guess, like Hitler, you know. Hitler was just a name, you know, a German name, but like now it's revered.
Yeah.
It's,
well, even the first name, like you name a kid Adeline, don't you think that's probably not as popular anymore?
Yes,
right?
Even that. Yeah. All right. So Saint Lucifer. So this was around the 4th century CE Common Era. And during that time is when the Constantinian dynasty was kind of taking over and kind of transforming the old world of paganism and all that stuff and trying to just fit it all into one kind of Christian kingdom to make it easier to rule. And during that time, there was a schism or a doctrine that was being spread throughout the priesthood and the kingdom, which was that of Arianism. And Arianism basically teaches that Jesus was a separate creation apart from God, and that God simply donned Jesus to be the Christ incarnate on earth, meaning that following that logic, any other person could also be given that privilege. So it was kind of a lousy excuse for the Constantinian dynasty to claim Christhood on earth.
Oh, okay. So they were like, oh yeah, Jesus is, I think I understand. It's a little, I'm not like a raised in this tradition or like a religious scholar. So the nuance is a little bit hard for me to get my head around in terms of how that's different than the normal conceptualization of the Trinity. Could you just, for our listeners, just a little bit more on that?
Yes. Yes. And also I am no expert on that as well as,
like, okay.
But it is something I've studied. And this, the schisms, pretty much the derivatives or variations of Christianity, are wild. There's so many different things, especially in the early days of Christianity, you know, the first few centuries of the Common Era. There were so many different types of Christianities that were trying to form their own narratives. Of course, like we had Gnosticism and its broad variations. And then later on, we'd get evangelicals and Protestants and all these different forms, right? So, and during that era, they were all trying to scurry and decide what they were going to teach. You know, what is the truth? And there are all kinds of psychedelic doctrines that were being formed. But as of right now, I guess you can say the universal truth or the universally accepted truth about Jesus and God in the church would be that Jesus was an emanation of God. He was God in the flesh. That's what they teach in the church, that God incarnated as a man here on earth. That's like the thing about Christianity.
Interesting. I feel like Jesus like said, that's so interesting. Again, thank you so much. I'm learning so much tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Arianism was teaching, what Arianism was teaching was like seen as preposterous by some of the more loyal priests and bishops, because they were basically saying that, you know, Jesus wasn't God, that Jesus was just a man who was donned by God. And in that logic, any other man on earth could be given that privilege. So as Arianism was happening, there were certain bishops that were opposing this. And One of them who was opposing it was the famous Saint Lucifer, who was the bishop of Cagliari in Italy. And him and his, he had some followers who were actually known as the Luciferians, but they're not like the Luciferians that we know of today.
And also the Arian is different than the way it's used in some common vernacular here. It's named after a guy, not whatever else Himalayan ancient peoples that might have existed. Yeah, sorry. Exactly. Yeah, just wanted to point that out too. Because a lot of technical language that could be contextualized differently and make it very confusing and upsetting for people, I suppose, here.
Yeah. Right? So, yes. Yes. That's the whole reason I had to write the book, is all these mistranslations and misunderstandings of just words. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, I know you're correct. It was named after a dude named I forgot his name, Arius. Yeah, it was
Arius. Cool.
Yep. Arius, and but Saint Lucifer and his followers are the Luciferians, and a couple of his friends and contemporaries were trying to fight this and protest it, and they were banished and they were exiled. So Saint Lucifer was exiled, and during his exile, he wrote some polemical, or you know, basically some heated letters towards the Constantinian dynasty. They were just kind of like open letters, or what we would call today tweets.
Yeah, it's like throwing shade, basically.
Yeah, exactly. He wrote to Constantius II, one of Constantine's sons, in his letter known as the Apostate of Kings. And he says in that pretty much that, well, I'll read a quote from it right here. He says, he's saying to Constantius II, "You say, if I have done evil, then God would have punished me. But listen to the Holy Scripture, even in the end, you know, they will receive the reward of their crimes." So he's basically saying like, yeah, like what you're doing now may not be causing you harm, but eventually things will be sorted out. So Saint Lucifer is trying to fight against Arianism in the Constantinian dynasty, and he's exiled. And later on, the Constantines die and new kings, new emperors arise, and they're more sympathetic to the anti-Arians, and they allow Saint Lucifer to come back. But this time he's debating whether all these sellouts should be given forgiveness and allowed back into the church. Yeah. And so now he's like debating that. And now there's all these religious theological debates going on, and all the Arians who sold out are kind of like saying, now they're saying, well, I mean, Jesus is the only one who can forgive us, you know, or God's the only one that can forgive us, like not you. So now they're using Saint Lucifer's logic against him. So he's just kind of becomes this disheveled, old, like bitter dude. And
he's like, fuck, they have a good point.
Yeah, exactly. And during this whole time, a key witness to this whole thing was a dude by the name of Eusebius Hieronymus, or better known as Jerome, who ended up translating and writing the Latin Vulgate, where we get the Lucifer word. So, and he wrote about this in a text called Dialogue Against the Luciferians. He kind of just chronicles Saint Lucifer's social downfall and how he ended up being disgraced through those debates. And so some people have speculated, as I do in the book, that that could have been another reason or another metaphor on top of Isaiah's metaphors of Hillel, Astar, and Venus for the word Lucifer. Because during that time, Constantine and his dynasty were Christ or God on earth, and Saint Lucifer was a literal Lucifer fighting against them, but ended up losing.
Yeah, falling down to earth, huh?
Yes.
All right. Fuck yeah. Well, this is super interesting. How do you feel about taking a bibliomancy break?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right. Fuck yeah. Hey, what's up? It's me again, Luxa from the future. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to be getting to that bibliomancy break with Eddie in just a little bit, as well as getting into a new thought experiment, which I think tethers pretty nicely to the question that Eddie asks for the bibliomancy. After the interview, we will revisit the thought experiment from the last episode regarding Mary, Qualia, and the black and white room in which Mary lives, as well as hearing thoughts about the one which I will present today. But first, I'm very stoked to bring you an episode within the episode featuring Rachel, who, as I mentioned before, is a total badass. She's putting together something very cool regarding Steel Mace Flow and the Green Mushroom Project, which I'm super stoked about, and I'm super stoked to participate in. I will let her explain, though. Let's go ahead and dive in. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Absolutely.
Before we get into it here, would you mind just going ahead and introducing yourself and telling me and the listeners like what you're up to and what you're about and all that?
All right. So I'm Rachel, and I come from the suburbs of Philadelphia. I am a personal trainer and a practicing chaos magician. So part-time personal trainer. I'm a full-time electronic builder, but that's really boring. So
that doesn't sound boring to me, but continue going.
Yeah. So my real passion though is personal training and fitness and magic, of course, is a huge part of my life. So.
Hell yeah. So tell me about the Steel Mace and its connection to chaos magic.
So this has been really freaking interesting to me to learn of all these things. So within like my fitness practice and stuff, I started using this kind of like unconventional fitness tool called the Steel Mace. And so the mace is I mean, when you think of steel mace, you probably think of like a weapon, you know, from like the medieval times or something that has like the spiky ball or something. So the mace is probably at least 1,000 years old, and it's been used as a weapon in many cultures, right? So over in India, they have these things called gadas. So the mace in India is basically the gada, and it was used as a weapon in war. They would ride on horsebacks with them and like smash people's heads with them and stuff. Really cool shit. So now, the wrestling gyms in India started using them to help develop strength with grappling, because when you're swinging this like heavy ballistic tool around your body, it creates like spinal flexibility, so you can like reach and grab people faster and be stronger. Really cool stuff. And they still practice with maces and swing maces in India today. You can go to these, I'm going to butcher the name, it's like Akara is what they're called, and they swing them, and they have competitions, really cool stuff. So you also probably, like, people are probably familiar with Hanuman, the monkey god in Hindu religion, and Hanuman has a mace. So if you, like, Google pictures of Hanuman, you'll see him holding this thing, and that's a gada or a mace. So that's pretty cool. So anyways, the mace came to America not too long ago, probably like less than 20 years ago, I'd say. And it was brought here by this guy, Jake Shannon, who's a wrestler. He has his wrestling, I guess, like business name is Scientific Wrestling. So you can go to like scientificwrestling.com and see all what he's about. Anyways, and there, scientificwrestling.com, Jake Shannon's page, you'll start to see how chaos magic and the mace go together. His logo's a freaking chaos star.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so Jake Shannon of Scientific Wrestling is a chaos magician. Which was really freaking, so when I learned that he was the guy that brought the mace over to Western culture, And then I like went to his website and like looked into him, and I'm like, holy shit, like this guy's a chaos magician. This is nuts. but it also makes like it makes a lot of other things make sense too, which has been really interesting. But I'm not gonna go into too much about it. But yeah, apparently he discovered the mace doing interviews with professional wrestler, this guy Carl Gotch. And after learning about the mace, he made one and brought it over to us Westerners. So that's pretty cool. So anyways, the other thing too is now when you look at these modern day maces, you know, it's like a cannonball attached to a barbell, you know? So like in a way, like it kind of, at a glance, like it looks like an arm of the Chaos Star. So okay. It's kind of like, yeah, so it's like, I don't know, maybe that's a coincidence, but I don't know. I've talked with a few other like practitioners and we're thinking like it's probably not a coincidence.
I love that. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, so you know, and with chaotic things too, like there's a little bit of drama that comes with like the steel mace community, but it's like, I don't know. It's just, it's so entwined with magic, you know, like it's ridiculous. Anyway.
Totally. I feel like there's drama with every community. I think it's just, I think it's more of like a feature than a bug with community in general, right? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's always a little bit of chaos, but yeah, but all in good fun. So yeah.
Fuck yeah. So you had told us that you are working on a project regarding steel mace and the green mushroom and all of that. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the flavor of steel mace that I practice in particular is called steel mace flow. And with steel mace flow, basically we make up these flows and they have meaning behind them. Or, I mean, you could just move around and have fun in flow state, which is also really fun. But a lot of us that practice make up like a series of movements and put them together and kind of like rep them out, right? Mm-hmm. And recently I have been playing around with this idea that my flows have meaning and I share my flows with other people who do flows. And they do the flows. And then because I'm a, you know, I practice magic, I'm like, my flows are like sigils, basically. And when other people practice my flow, it kind of turns them into like an egregore, which puts more energy into the meaning that I put behind the flow, basically. So considering that I'm a part of the Green Mushroom community and, you know, there's so much good energy here, I figured that making a flow for the Green Mushroom could be yet another way that we could bring this good, powerful energy into the Green Mushroom project. So my idea is to make a flow. So usually when I make flows, I just like come up with them and I put them together myself. But for this particular green mushroom flow, I'm going to use divination, which I've been playing around with recently. It's been a lot of fun, where I have the movements kind of listed out, and then I roll dice to, you know, like, this is my intention, and then I come up with the flow through divination, which has been pretty cool. So using our, like, resist statement, I'll use divination to come up with a flow with through that intention. And then basically I've been making these maces. And that was another thing too that kind of really like pushed me to be like, I have to share this with my magic friends because I started making my own maces and it's been fairly easy and it's a lot of fun and I can put a lot of like creative energy into it. It's kind of like an art project / like fitness thing. So
yeah,
so basically we'd have our maces, you know, whether like it's something someone already has or, you know, like I'm going to be making these like green mushroom maces, magic maces, and then we'll do the flow together in a way that's, you know, like, I don't know, I think of like Native American war dance, how like they have something and then they do like their dance to like draw energy and purpose and meaning behind that thing that they're dancing for. So this is in a similar vein. Basically, we'll all have our maces and we'll do this flow together to bring energy into the Green Mushroom Project.
Heck yeah, I love it. Yeah, there's so much about that is super fucking dope. Like, I really love that you've taken, you know, a way to sort of become more physically, somatically involved, because I think that that's something that can be overlooked. And I think it's really important to stay balanced and all that. And I don't know. Yeah, there's just so much about that is fucking dope. So thank you so much for sharing, and I'm really fucking looking forward to this. I can't wait to get my hands on one of these things and try it out. So where can people like find you and your stuff and like these cool maces and everything? Like where should people look if they like want to check all this out?
Cool. So I guess for people, if they want to stay up to date on the Green Mushroom based magic projects, that they would probably be best to check out the Faith Blind Council Discord server and get on our Green Mushroom chat.
Yeah, and I'll definitely like announce it on the show too for people that like don't use Discord and everything. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And then so I'm making maces for if people want to do this who aren't particular. So the mace that I practice with for fitness is 10 pounds, and that's a lot. And I like most people, you know, if you've never worked out or like lifted anything, this thing is, you know, 10 pounds is a lot. And they make other size ones anyways to make it, because this is like a passion project of mine and I really want to just share this and put maces in everybody's hands. I'm going to be making these maces and really, I'm going to keep it really affordable, because like I said, I just want people to be able to do this with us, you know, get as much energy behind it as possible. So anyways, all I'm asking for is like shipping. And like, if you want to donate more, like that's cool, you know?
Fuck yeah. Well, that's super generous of you, dude. Fuck yeah. We'll have to talk about this. I don't want you to like be too much out of pocket on this either. So we can talk about it, but yeah, totally. Fuck yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, but people can find me on probably best on Instagram. So it's _Rachel RACHAEL dot Elizabeth ELIZABETH and then _. So, yeah, so that's definitely the best place for people to find me.
Hell yeah, and there'll be links to that in the show notes for sure.
Cool.
So is there anything that you want to talk about that I didn't ask you about, or thoughts or questions or comments or anything that you want to share?
No, I think I'm good.
All right, fuck yeah. Well, I'm super stoked to check this out. I'd really like to try Steel Mace out. It looks really rad. And yeah, after hearing you speak about it, I'm way more stoked about it than I was before. So fuck yeah.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for taking a couple minutes to hang with me today and for putting all this work into this very fucking cool thing. I'm so stoked about it.
Cool.
All right, fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Rachel for taking the time. Super stoked for all of that for sure. Don't miss the show notes for links. One thing that Rachel and I discussed after we stopped recording was the fact that doing a steel mace practice is a great way to connect with the outdoors, which is yet another cool thing about this. So fuck yeah. All right, I want to return briefly to what I said during the last break about what I sometimes think about as the universe machine or system of systems. It's very like Newtonian, right? Anyway, I mentioned this in the context of talking about etymology and how many moving parts the definitions of words have. You know, the concept is universal, and so you could apply it to anything, though. Anyway, I said that thing about schematics for the universe machine, which I'm actually really not thrilled about saying, so I sort of want to redact it. But instead, I'm going to qualify it and say that the schematics would have to be dynamic, since it's a system that's always changing. Or conversely, maybe it's one way to think about the goal of the Wolfram Physics Project, which I gush about in episode 36, if you're curious. Anyway, I'm guessing that people who are into Kabbalah might hear me say this and say, but Luxa, we already have such a thing. And perhaps that's true for some people. I don't know. I can certainly see the appeal of the organizational system for sure. There's also a lot there for me that just doesn't satisfy. Also, don't get me started on some of the problematic historical stuff involved. Well, history is endlessly problematic, isn't it? I will leave it there before I get lost in the weeds too much further. But if you'd like to hear more about how problematic history is, check out the podcast that my brother and I make called Ad Hoc History. It's not the history podcast you wanted, it's the history podcast you deserve. Okay, let's do some thought experimentation. All right, this one is called The Experience Machine. It's something that Robert Nozick came up with. This is a classic thought experiment about the importance of being connected to reality, whatever that is. It went through several iterations, but in its kind of mature form, you can find it in the book The Examined Life, which came out in 1989. Okay, so this is how it is in there. Imagine a machine that could give you any experience or sequence of experiences you might desire. When connected to this experience machine, you can have the experience of writing a great poem, or bring about world peace, or loving someone and being loved in return. You can experience the felt pleasures of things, how they feel from the inside. You can program your experiences for the rest of your life. If your imagination is impoverished, you can use the library of suggestions extracted from biographies and enhanced by novelists and psychologists. You can live your fondest dreams from the inside. All right, so if there's a thing, would you choose to do this for the rest of your life? Upon entering, you will not remember having done this, so no pleasures will be ruined by realizing they are not real and are machine-produced. Okay, so that's the question. Would you go into the experience machine? We'll come back after the interview to talk more about this. And I'll be back during a break in a little while to talk about Mary and Mary's black and white room and qualia. But now, here is the Bibliomancy break with Esoteric Eddie. All right, fuck yeah. Well, welcome to the Bibliomancy break, Esoteric Eddie. So the way this works is I will have you ask a question, and then I will roll a D8 and a D4, unless you have polyhedral dice with you. No. Then you can roll those.
No, I think I have some these dice with little weed leaves on them.
Okay, so that's cool.
But no, I'll leave that up to you.
All right, well, I have some right here. So go ahead and ask the question, and I will figure out what text we are going to consult.
Okay, so just any question, huh?
Yeah, you can ask the oracle whatever you like.
All right, just give me a moment here. Let me see.
Okay, take your time.
All right. Cool. Yeah, I was like going to try and get deep, you know, but I feel like I was just going to just keep going and going in my mind and not come up with anything.
I know how that goes.
So I'm just gonna be a basic bitch and just ask, are we living in a simulation?
All right, interesting question. Nothing wrong with being a basic bitch, anyway. I don't think that is that basic though. I don't know. Although I guess a lot of people. All right, so let's see here. We are gonna be using, let's see, table 5, item 2. Ooh, Time Loops by Eric Wargo. Very fun.
All right, all right.
All right, let me grab it here. Right here. Oh, Eris. Are we living in a simulation? Resonances between future upheavals and present situations manifested in dreams and creative flow states may even be responsible for the very shape of culture, a constant cycling between precognition and confirmation.
Interesting. I like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of taps in with some of the studies that I've been doing on, like, the hologram and archetypes.
I think that, like, okay, so yeah, this is definitely about these, like, you know, sort of feedback loop idea, right? And,
yeah,
you know, I'm not sure. Like, I've wondered about this myself, about the whole simulation thing. And, like, the thing that I keep coming back to is that I'm not sure if it matters. But I'm not sure about that either.
Well, no, you're right. That's actually the same conclusion I gave to somebody that I was having a conversation with, sort of a debate with a while back. He was a cool dude. He claimed to, or he was a philosophy major. And I was just kind of telling him the origins of the simulation theory that come from Plato, or how Plato kind of also talked about that. And he was kind of getting like frustrated, you know, because I knew so much about philosophy and he had a major in it. But I pretty much concluded the same thing. I was like, look, man, I'm just conversating with you, you know, like it really does. Like it doesn't really matter, you know, whether we live in it or not. You know, what matters again is how we can impact our lives today and right now in a healthy way.
Yeah. And I think I do think like equating it with like a sort of like, you know, Platonic way of looking at things makes a lot of sense, right? Like it's sort of something that we've been wondering about for a really, really long time, everybody. So yeah. It's okay. I've talked to people who are like genuinely, they seem genuinely like upset about thinking, you know, like, and I wish I could just, you know, reassure them and say, look, it's okay. You're not the first one that's worried about this. And we've come along. It's okay.
Yeah, we got this. Absolutely. Well, I like that answer. That's cool. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure, dude. Thank you. Okay, so maybe we should talk a little bit about Zoroaster because it's such an important dude. Zoroastrianism, you know, the concept of an afterlife, the concept of the battle between good and evil.
Yes. Okay. So, of course, Zoroastrianism goes back to about the 1200 or the 12th century BC, at least. Its legendary roots go farther back than that. But as the story goes, or Zoroaster was this priest or this prophet in the old Persian world who came to radicalize it from polytheism to monotheism. He had a vision around the age of 30, I believe, by a river. And this vision was an angel or an emissary of Ahura Mazda, the wise lord, who gave him this mission to go on to radicalize the world from polytheism to monotheism. And him as a character it's legendary. We don't really have anything historical or evidential about him other than the Zoroastrian writings known as the Avesta or the Gathas. But what makes him important to the story of Lucifer is that many people have studied and kind of concluded that Zoroastrianism influenced Judaism. And Judaism itself, it can be broken up into pre-exilic Judaism and post-exilic Judaism, meaning prior to the Babylonian captivity and after the Babylonian captivity. And prior to the Babylonian captivity, which was around roughly around 600 BC, Judaism was polytheistic. They were kind of formulating out of the old world religions and belief systems of these multiple deities, which all kind of stem from the Sumerian pantheon. But it was when they were exiled and held under captivity by the Babylonians around 600 BC, roughly, that they kind of started to mingle with these other religions and these other priests. And especially when King Cyrus the Persian came and set them free and allowed them to go back to their homeland and continue to practice their religions, that they probably intermingled even more so with Zoroastrians. And we see that after the Babylonian exile, that Judaism started to form into how we know it today, into this structural religion surrounding the Torah and these ideas of heaven and hell, and these ideas of a judgment day, and the idea of this, you know, this good benevolent God and this evil, you know, being, and all those things are precedented in Zoroastrianism.
Interesting. Okay. That's, I mean, yeah, and I'm curious, 'cause like when we're talking about, these different like religions and stuff, like what we contextualize as like the modern take on Judaism sounds really different than what you're describing here too. So that's really interesting. And obviously there's like a million different ways to like qualify all these things. I'm curious, like what kind of archaeology or like I'm kind of curious about like what kind of work has been done to like look into this stuff because it was so long ago. Like are we talking about like clay tablets here or like
For the Zoroastrian writings?
yeah.
Okay, so what we have what is called the Avesta, which is their sacred writings, and those. Let me see. I don't want to get the date wrong, but until I find it, I'll just carry on. So, the Avesta is based on the Vedas, and the Vedas are what Hinduism, modern day Hinduism, is based on as well.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and the Vedas they belong to the I want to say the old Iranian. Not sorry, Iranian, the old Aryan civilization. Let me see, the proto-Aryan civilizations. And that some of those would be
And
like,
this is like in India, right? Or around there.
no, actually it's kind of like in the Middle East, sort of
Oh, okay.
like Syria and that kind of area. And then they broke off. Eventually they broke off and then went to India and other parts of the world.
Okay,
But this
radical.
is, yeah, so modern Hinduism and Zoroastrianism, their source material for their religions and some of their culture comes from the Vedas. And so to answer your question, as far as archaeology, there are, I don't know what the oldest Zoroastrian temple is, but it's definitely not older than the Avesta, to my understanding. The Avesta, the writings are like the actual pinnacle of its existence. But the writings itself don't go that far back. They don't go further back than the Vedas, which I believe were the as right now can only be substantiated to about 1400 BC.
Hell yeah. All right. So another colorful character that we have in our cast here is Helena Blavatsky.
Yes.
And everybody probably that listens to the show is probably familiar with her on some level. I know we've talked about her before, but like one thing that I did think was interesting that you brought up was her sort of conceptualization. And I know that she's a interesting and sometimes problematic figure in history, as are many of these folks. But the idea that the serpent, in the story of the Garden of Eden or the fall or however you want to contextualize it, depending on who you're talking to, they'll call it different things, it seems like. But there's this idea that the serpent is really the sort of creator of the human. Like we don't really become actual like humans as we are now until we eat the apple and have this, knowledge of good and evil and stuff. So in that way, the serpent's kind of our creator in a way, which I thought was interesting. And I actually, when I first heard that story, I was like, wait a minute. So yeah, so I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, she did, she played a huge role in how Lucifer and Luciferianism would develop into today's society. But yeah, she was very cool, psychedelic, mystic to say the least. And she was aware of the mistranslation of Lucifer that we went over earlier. I'm pulling up here now to quote from my book that apparently in her what is titled Collected Writings of Blavatsky, Volume 8, she speaks directly on that, saying, as I quote, "Here the word translated Lucifer is Hillel, and its meaning is shining brightly or gloriously." So she, as many of the classical cultists, as I call them, from 1700, 1800s, was aware of the mistranslation, but they were enamored by the philosophical potency of it and kind of just led with that, which is cool, but is the reason I scrutinize them for that in my book and say it's that's cool, but my main purpose and goal as a scholar is not to lead with dogma, but to lead with with facts and history.
Sure. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. You're up to something different than she was, it sounds like, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can see, like, you know, there is in, you know, this the show that, you know, I do, it's about chaos magic, or we look at things through that lens. And so there is this idea of, like, taking a powerful idea like Lucifer, the devil, and saying, like, well, what does this mean? And how can it be sort of, like, used as a symbol to achieve, you know, something with causal potency, right? Yeah. But you're not necessarily, like, needing to believe that it's an actual, like, thing that exists in the way that, like,
yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it exists, like, in something, like, other than a concept or a symbol. But
yeah. And I love the occult. Like, you know, I don't want people to get it wrong. Like, I love studying the occult. Like, I love esotericism and certain religions too. And as I mentioned earlier, when you asked me, you know, how do we, you know, get away from following certain conspiracies that could just be a waste of our time and stuff like that. Like, I don't think it's bad to study these things or lead with concepts or lead with ideas, because, I mean, that's what spirituality is about. It's about finding a source within your mind and within yourself that, you know, is bigger than you, that can help you navigate through life, right? And so although I scrutinize them in the book, because that's kind of my job as a writer, in my personal life, I'm actually fascinated by a lot of what they have to say. And I got them on my shelf all day long. Anytime I come across a Blavatsky or a Levy or any of the mystics, I got to throw it on the shelf, because there is philosophical power there.
Yeah, totally.
I just saw here too. She actually claimed or said that most mysticism in her time derives from Zoroaster. So Zoroaster to her was like a prime figure in how magic and mysticism developed and came from.
Hell yeah. That makes a lot of sense. 3, 2, 2, 4, 7, Bravo, Delta, Quebec. Hey, what's up? It's me again, Luxa from the future. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the episode. We're going to be returning for the rest of my chat with Eddie in just a little bit here, as well as hearing a fun surprise after the interview. But now, as promised, it's time to further foray into the wonderful world of philosophy. Let's revisit the thought experiment from last time with Mary and the Black and White Room. So this epistemological query was proposed in 1982 by philosopher Frank Jackson, and it goes a little something like this. Mary lives in a black and white room, reads black and white books, and uses a screen that only displays images in black and white, and with this learns everything that has ever been discovered about color, vision, in physics and biology, and anything else you can think of. One day, Mary's computer screen malfunctions and displays the color red, and for the first time ever, Mary sees color. So the question is, with this having happened, did Mary learn anything new? So you can hear more about this in the last episode, and we also have a nice discussion about the concept of qualia as it applies to doing astral work and communicating about how we do that and how those experiences play out for us. It's kind of interesting stuff. Okay, so a few folks reached out with thoughts about this, and nobody made any arguments against qualia, interestingly enough. Or perhaps it's not interesting, I don't know, given the pool from which we sample. I think intuitively there is something there for a lot of people. Anyway, thank you so much to BJ for reaching out with a video which shows two people who are colorblind putting on special glasses which allow them to see color for the first time. It's a very literal kind of response to this thought experiment, right? Because this can actually happen now to some extent. And they have this really emotional reaction to the experience, and it's quite moving to witness. There's obviously something happening there. There's going to be a link to that in the show notes, as well as to an article which explains how the glasses work. And here's a little bit about that, because I think it's interesting, from Technology Review. And thank you again to BJ for sharing this and for reaching out. Hell yeah. Okay, so this is a quote from Technology Review. They might look like sunglasses, but Enchroma's product actually boosts the saturation of red and green light. That helps to improve color vision in people with red-green color blindness, the most common color vision deficiency, which affects up to 1 in 12 males and 1 in 200 females. And a true lack of color vision is very rare. Most people have three types of color sensing cones in their eyes: red, green, and blue. The wavelengths of light that these cones absorb have overlapping regions. Color blindness is often a result of a malfunctioning cone that causes wavelengths to overlap even more, resulting in poor color discernment. The N-chroma glasses use a filter to cut out these overlapping wavelengths, allowing for a clearer distinction between the colors, especially red and green. So this invention was derived from the work of Don McPherson, who got his PhD in glass science, and he was trying to design some protective eyewear for doctors to use while performing laser surgeries. But it wasn't until he let his buddy try out the glasses during a game of Ultimate Frisbee that he realized the technology had another potential. McPherson's friend just happened to be colorblind, and the glasses gave both of them a huge shock. Okay, so I love that story. It's very interesting. And I really like that it highlights something that happens so often. Many meaningful and interesting, like, scientific and otherwise discoveries happen by accident or happenstance. I like this example too because it illustrates the importance of play. They didn't know what these glasses could do until they kind of took them out to this ultimate frisbee game and played with them. Douglas Adams wrote that to be a good scientist, one has to be like a child, to look at the world through new eyes always, to see first and ask questions later, but always see first. And I know I bring this up all the time. Okay, so we've seen a pretty good case for qualia, perhaps, with this video and everything. And you can write to me at luxocultpod@gmail.com and let me know your thoughts about this or anything else. But where are there, like, philosophical frictions regarding the concept of qualia? Like, who's not into it? And one place where we see some tangles come up has to do with the school of thought known as functionalism. And I'm looking at my script here, and it looks like I've written quite a bit about functionalism. I don't think I'm going to go through all of it here. I don't think it's necessary. But if you want to talk about functionalism, definitely hit me up. I'll lay it out just very simply. Like, this is a quote from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy that kind of, I think, nails it down somewhat well. So the intuition, you know, the sort of underlying idea for functionalists is that the function of a mental state is its defining feature. Like, mental states are defined in terms of the causal role they play in the entire system of the mind. That is, in terms of their causal relationship to sensory stimuli, behavior, and other mental states. So rather than this is the example they give, like, rather than defining pain in terms of, like, C fiber firing, which is like the biochemical mechanism by which this happens, functionalism would define pain in terms of the causal role it plays. Like, what does it make you do? Causing avoidance behavior, warning you of danger, etc. So this kind of way of looking at things is pretty attractive to me a lot of the times, I do have to say. Like, a lot of the time it matters to me a lot less, like, what something, quote, is, and more, like, what it does or how it works. What something is like, a stickier thing to me, right? It gets into semantics, and a lot of times it becomes less meaningful for that reason. Like, a lot of times what's interesting to me is, like, what is the causal way in which it interacts with the world? So, but yeah, there's obviously some problems with this, right? Like, let's go back to the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So, as plausible as functionalism might seem, however, it has long faced the charge that it is unable to account adequately for qualia. The causal role of a state seems to come apart from its qualitative aspects. So basically, when we get too into functionalism, we can cause our view to become, well, like, colorblind, I guess. We move further and further away from experiential knowledge and into abstraction in some cases, and we start drawing, like, wiring diagrams or whatever, when, like, an expressionist style painting might have been, like, a better way to describe what we're seeing. So to show this sort of idea of, like, coming apart from the qualitative aspect, people who are not into functionalism have mounted two different kinds of arguments. Like, some of them are aiming to show that, like, two systems might be functionally identical, even though only one of them has any qualia. I think an easy example here would be, like, a camera and an eye. Like, if you could design a camera that was very much systematically like a human eye, with a computer, you know, a processor or whatever, that would be like a brain. Would we say that the camera is experiencing things in the same way as the human eye is? The second class of arguments against functionalism are those aiming to show that the two systems might be functionally identical, even though they have vastly different qualia from one another. So in the first case, one had qualia and one didn't. And in the second case, they both have qualia, but the qualia is different. So here we come to a fucking classic. I know everybody's thinking about it right now. And I'm going to go ahead and we'll do it here. Okay, so this is the perfect time to return to something that's always, it's gotten a little bit under my skin, to be perfectly honest. And it's something that's known as the inverted qualia argument. I've also heard it referred to as the inverted spectrum hypothesis. So let's go back to the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy here. So a related objection to functionalism, falling into the second category, as I said, of the qualias being different, is the inverted qualia argument against functionalism, which arises from considering a possibility originally suggested by John Locke. Okay, so suppose that two people, Norma and Abby, are qualitatively inverted with respect to one another. Both of them refer to stop signs and Coke cans and Elmo as red, and both refer to sugar snap peas and Heineken bottles and Kermit the Frog as green. But Abby's phenomenal experience when they see a Coke can is like Norma's phenomenal experience when they see a Heineken bottle. When Norma sees the Coke can, they have a reddish experience. When Abby sees the Coke can, they have a greenish experience. Likewise, when Norma sees a Heineken bottle, they have a green experience, and vice versa. So qualitatively, the two are inverted to each other. So most people find this like pretty conceptually coherent, and functionalism doesn't have a lot to say about like this inversion, right? That functionally it's the same, so who cares, right? So Abby and Norma both refer to Coke cans as red, and they both indicate that this same color at stop signs and ripe tomatoes, blah, 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 right? Functionally speaking, there's nothing different here. But by hypothesis, since this is the scenario that we've imagined, right, they do have different qualitative experiences when they see the Coke can. So thus, it looks as if functional definition of mental states leave out the qualitative aspects of the mental states. So when we look at functionalism as a theory of cognition, it addresses the hard problem of consciousness by taking a broad fucking step around it. And I get this, like I said, that's like a deep hole to fall into. Anyway, we could get into the functionalist responses here. There's so much more, but why don't we leave it there? I'm curious to hear what you have to say about this. As always, you can reach me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com or on Instagram at luxoccultpod. I'm just going to go off script for just a second here to respond with one thing that it's just a little bit of like something that gives me like a little bit of friction with this like whole inverted qualia thing in specific regard to color. Just because I feel like color is measurable, right? It's like a specific like wavelength on the electromagnetic spectrum that we interpret, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we could imagine a scenario in the future where, you know, we might be able to analyze like the firings of neurons to sort of like see which type of, you know, wavelength they're interacting with or whatever. I suppose this doesn't necessarily actually get to qualia though. I don't know, maybe debatable though. Curious to hear people's thoughts about it. I already think of a lot of objections to what I've just said, so I'm obviously going to have to consider it further. But while I do that, let's go ahead and return to the rest of my interview with Esoteric Eddie, in which he will reveal what he has learned and sort of like his kind of takeaway ideas from his research into Lucifer. I hope you're enjoying. Thank you so much for listening. Let's dive right back in here. Okay, so you mentioned, and this is like getting into the new age, you mentioned this idea of spiritual narcissism. And this is something that comes up a lot in some of my circles, like this idea that this can happen a few different ways, but like, you know, that sometimes things can become unbalanced and people can get into sort of these like maybe toxic patterns or what have you.
Yeah. And this goes for both spectrums, you know, the theological spectrum, as I call it, you know, all the televangelists and preachers and, you know, pastors, you know, that spectrum, the theological spectrum, and also on the other side of the spectrum, the full-on fledged practicing dark arts occultist, you know, from far, you know, in between both of those and everywhere, you can come across narcissists or people who cling on to these ideas, these philosophical ideas, wholeheartedly, and kind of view the rest of the world as unworthy or whatever. And to me, as a scholar of history, it's just kind of funny because growing up in the church, I've witnessed it firsthand with on the theological side, where they're condemning the world and people through the usage of the Bible. And I'm just sitting there like, you don't even know the Bible yourself. You know, like the church is a joke in my mind. They don't even fully understand the Bible and its history and all those other intricacies. So it's a joke to me for them to use it as a dogma to condemn the world as if they're below them. But the same goes for the other side, you know, the dark arts occultists who, well, whatever, just think that Christians and people who are of the light or just regular daily people are just lost and are sheeple and don't know anything. And because they are in tune with Azazel or they talk to Lucifer and all the, or all these random things. And I think both of them, although have things that we can gain that are cool and interesting and useful, as a scholar, they're both kind of playing the same silly game of picking characters and creating personalities out of these characters. They're the same game. They're playing the same game out of the same board game, out of the same box, just different characters. And my goal and my purpose as a writer, as a scholar, historian, is to put the game away and say, look, these are all fictional characters. And unless we come to mature adult realizations and understandings of that, and then go from there, then all we're doing is having these arguments and debates over whose characters are cooler or more powerful.
Fuck yeah, dude. Yeah, I could not have said it better myself. I love that metaphor of the game board. Fuck yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I can't let you get away before I ask you about one of my favorite parts. And this is just something that you mentioned in passing. But so Ian Fleming, who was the person that wrote the James Bond novels, used to be in British intelligence. And apparently, as you say, he knew Aleister Crowley and based a Bond villain off of him.
Yeah, and that's something that caught my eye too when I was doing the research.
It's not surprising, to be honest. I mean, if we think about who Crowley was, he sort of is a fucking Bond villain.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess he like actually modeled the look of one of the villains after him. I'm trying to remember what the villain's name was. But Crowley was a famous guy in his day, and he was charismatic, and he had friends and ties to British intelligence, and he was just loved by the entertainment industry. You know, we see him on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's whatever by the Beatles, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because he was just such a firebrand, you know, like he was so hated, you know, for so long. And so, yeah, putting it sort of just using him as a symbol, almost like people used the devil as a symbol, I think, in a lot of ways. Like it's like a sort of edgy thing that you could just, you know, toss into the mix and be like, ooh, spooky or whatever. Right. Like,
yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. He's definitely been a scapegoat over the years, and also just a figure and an archetype. Also now, for so many,
he was legit things. Like a terrible person though too. I just want to throw that out there. He really was. Like, yes.
Yeah, there's so many mixed feelings about him. You know.
Sure. I'm not getting down to anybody that like enjoys his writings or anything like that. Like, and there's all kinds of great stuff in there, and yeah. People have found a lot of value in it. I'm just looking at, you know, the things that he did in his life. A lot of more abusive and fucked up to the people around him, and I think that that's not right. So yeah.
Yes. No. Yeah. That's true. Like, he was very abusive. I guess I don't know if this is true. I haven't fact checked this, but apparently, like, a lot of his wives committed suicide.
A lot of people that were around him ended up committing suicide. So yeah, it's very sad.
I'm interested though. Like, what are the things that you find like, I guess, grotesque or fucked up about him?
Well, I try to look at him as, you know, as a historical figure and sort of in that context and stuff. And I do try to have like, you know, when I look back in history, I do try to have like empathy for these people and try to get like the context where they're coming from. I think that he was sort of, I don't know. I'm not like a psychologist or whatever, but a lot of people have said that maybe he had some kind of like a personality disorder and that's what ended up making him behave so poorly. Some people said that he became possessed by a demon that he was working with. I'm not sure what happened, but I think that, you know, for somebody that is in sort of like this position of leadership and has all this charisma and like, you know, has these ideas that people are really loving, for them to, in their private life, treat the people around them really shitty, it's just a sort of like really gross hypocrisy that's just like, yeah, it's just kind of, I feel actually a lot of contempt for that. Like when people like, are nasty to the people that they're supposed to be like taking care of or whatever. Or, you know, it's like when people kick their dog, right? You know, you can feel contempt for that, right?
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. I hear what you're saying. And I only ask because I've heard, you know, so many things from different sides. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, yeah, he definitely did some fucked up shit. And I think he was kind of like a spoiled dude, you know, he just...
Oh, yeah, super privileged, super entitled, like lots of, you know, also very smart, really, like a very, very smart person, really good at making these interesting connections and making some kind of like interesting points. And, you know, yeah, it's not all one thing, right?
So, yeah. Yeah, no, and he's kind of a prime example of like how far off the deep end you can go with esotericism and occultism.
Sure. Well, hell yeah. Before we get too far off the deep end, I'm going to ask you, is there anything that you would like to talk about that I didn't ask you about?
Good question. Let me see. Well, yeah, I guess just to kind of reveal who Lucifer is or who I believe Lucifer is. So, of course, we had the terminological misunderstanding in the early days that created the concept of Lucifer. And one of the first people in the church to kind of start solidifying that concept was a dude by the name of Origen Adamantius. And he was kind of a psychedelic dude as well. And we're talking like 100, we're talking basically second century Common Era. Origen Adamantius, he had these psychedelic ideas about God and the Bible, and he wrote in his book called De Principis that we are taught, and I'm quoting here, that we are taught as follows by the prophet Isaiah regarding another opposing power who formerly was Lucifer. He might show by this that he had been at one time in heaven and had enjoyed a share in that light which all the saints participate. So this is like one of the first, you know, pieces of evidence within the church that we see where Lucifer is being conceptualized as this being. But Origen Adamantius was later deemed a heretic and was imprisoned and then came out kind of disheveled and died. But he has some pretty cool writings. And one of the reasons he was also deemed a heretic was because of his ideas of the angels at one time being corporeal or as being physical and being able to mate with humans, which was accepted early on in the church. But quickly as Christianity formed through the Western world, the idea of angels being corporeal or physical beings was snuffed out and deemed as heretical. And that's why now they're just seen as these spiritual beings. But at one time, they were seen as physical beings, primarily through the Book of Enoch, which was huge in like 2nd and 3rd century BC, but was later taken out by the church because of its detailing of the angels being physical and teaching mankind evil ways and mating with them. And to me, all of that stems from the Sumerian stories of them and their gods creating us and intermingling with us. And so when I take all of this into consideration, we see that the serpent in the Garden of Eden, who was also sometimes lumped together with Lucifer, is actually the Sumerian deity Enki, who was among what we would call the fallen angels, who try to show us certain pieces of knowledge and help elevate our consciousness.
All right, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so early on in the church, you know, Lucifer was being conceptualized, and then later on, it was the occultists who saw this and then took it and also ran with it, primarily through Eliphas Levi. He was kind of like the bridge between the theological world and the occult world. I'm not sure if you know this, but like Eliphas.
Yeah, he's a big name in the occult for sure.
Yeah, I actually have a documentary I put together on him on my YouTube, Esoteric 80 TV. I was amazed when I came across his story because there's not much out there. There's actually only one biography in English on him, which is what I based my documentary on. And he's a fascinating dude. Of course, as we all know, he illustrated the Baphomet image, which is famous in the occult.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Yeah, he actually drew that. And as most people on both sides of the spectrum of, dogma, they sometimes view it as an image of Satan or Lucifer. But when you study what he saw it as, it was actually just this image that represented the duality of life in general. And he says that he kind of breaks down the different symbolisms, and it's just an image to me. He didn't draw it to represent any particular person or deity or anything. It's actually just an image comprising of multiple elements that explain the duality of nature and the free will to choose between those dualities.
Yeah, and I think for me too, like when I feel like what I feel about Baphomet too is that it's not just about the duality, it's about like the union of the duality. Like it exists, you know, in this one creature, right?
Yeah.
Or this one entity or whatever, right? Like
Yeah, it can be seen that way too. And so Eliphas Levi, however we'd like to say it. I always try to remember that Led Zeppelin song, "When the Levee Breaks." Like so Levi.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it's because like sometimes I say Levi or Levi. I'm like, just stick to one, damn it.
So, I have no idea what the right one is. So yeah, don't ask me.
I just think of that Zeppelin song, just Levi. So Levi was kind of the bridge between the old Christian world and the new occult world because he was a Catholic mystic. He actually had a huge love for Catholicism and the Bible, and wrote from a perspective of a mystical Christian, or more specifically, a mystical Catholic, but kind of broke through that. And then towards the end of his life, kind of was way more on the spectrum of mysticism and occultism. But and he was aware also of the terminological misunderstanding of Lucifer. He was educated. He knew that. He wasn't, you know, deceived by it, but he, as the occultists later on would do, took the concept, the powerful concept of Lucifer, and used it to formulate ideas off of. So through that bridge of Levi, the occult was born and took his idea of Lucifer and then ran with it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's deep.
Yeah, he's a really interesting dude. Yeah, there's one of my friends does a podcast and he covered him, and he talks about how he was this sort of like famous magician that really didn't do very much magic. Like he wrote a lot about it, and he apparently just like did this one kind of intense thing, and it really like fucking scared him, and he like never did anything else ever again.
Yeah.
But he was fascinated by it, which is very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. He was probably talking about when he had to summon a ghost or something, right? He had to summon this entity for this rich lady.
I think he had some kind of evocation, and yeah.
Yeah. This like rich lady just like contacted him, and she asked him to do this, and he was supposed to do it with her and her friend, but they backed out last minute. So he ended up doing it by himself. And part of the evocation, he was going to ask a question for them and then also ask a question for him. But what I found interesting was the entity or the spirit that he was summoning was actually the spirit of Polyanus of Tyana, who's also a very famous figure within esotericism, who some people say the character of Jesus was based off of. But yeah, he was an interesting dude. I like his story. I honestly think it could be a really good movie. Like his life story is like that interesting.
Hell yeah. All right. Well, we'll have to check out that documentary that you made.
Yeah. Just another fun fact. Like when he decided to leave the church altogether, his mom committed suicide.
Oh, that's very sad. Yeah. I think I remember hearing that. Yeah. That sucks. Cause she was just like super into the fact that she really wanted him to be in the church.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad.
Yeah. It's like, wait, just wait. He's going to be really famous. I swear.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, okay. So, not to leave it on that note, is there anything that you want to ask me?
Sure. I mean, what were your ideas of Lucifer prior to reading my work, and how do you feel about it now?
You know, my ideas about it were actually pretty similar. I didn't, of course, have all the historical context and stuff, but my sort of conceptualization of it was sort of similar to where you ended up sort of coming to. For me, this has always been, I've never been the sort of person that like takes things super literally. I always tend to view things as pretty like abstract and stuff. So like these kinds of things have always been sort of like concepts. And so I loved when you mentioned the game pieces, because that's really sort of how I've viewed it for pretty much as long as I can remember. I remember like as a kid, like hearing about all these different religions and sort of having this conceptualization of like this big fire that everybody is like standing around in a circle, and like they're looking at the same fire, but they can't see like the same angles of it. And like, it's always changing anyway. So it's like, nobody's going to agree what it looks like exactly, even though they're looking at the same thing. I know there's like a whole bunch of other ways to like phrase this, but that was just the one that sort of cropped up for me first. And so, yes, I agree. I think with a lot of like the broad strokes, like, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's cool.
I think for me, like conceptually, Lucifer has been an idea about, you know, like self-discipline and like striving to become better or like more, I don't know, maybe actualized than you are. Like this idea of like having this, you know, vision or dream and then being able to like bring it down to earth, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I could see why the concept of it was so enticing to the occultists, and it is enticing, you know, like it's that's why rock music has used it over and over, you know, like Black Sabbath. I love that song, NIB, you know, it's just all enticing. And actually, I like what I think it's Levy said, his conceptualization of it was kind of similar to what you just said, that Lucifer is the light bearer, but he's also can be represented as the flame, the fire, and that the fire can consume you. Lucifer only becomes Satan when the light has consumed you and has now become a fire. That's Levy. Yeah, that's what he said. And I like that.
Yeah, with any of this shit, you know, like there's always a downside, you know, like it's like fire is dope, right? Like, but it's a great, it's our like one of our first technologies, right? Yeah. It's super useful. Like we need it for real. But it's also super dangerous. Like if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to burn your house down, or if something goes wrong, right? So there's always like a danger with this stuff. And I think that that's a sort of idea of like knowledge has to be balanced with wisdom, maybe would be a way to say it, or like.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think there's some serious stuff to this too. Like when I'm doing my scholarly work and I'm writing from a historical perspective, but in my personal life, I've had paranormal and spiritual experiences, and I have dabbled in, you know, lower levels of magic and stuff like that. And so, but now in my older age, I'm kind of starting to study Jungian psychology, the subconscious mind, the collective subconscious mind and archetypes. And I'm starting to realize that magic, psychology, quantum physics are all different perspectives of the same thing, the same power. So whether we're using magic or those other forms of sciences, we're contacting things that we don't really have too much hold over or too much experience with, and they can cause some danger and some damages to us.
Yeah, totally. I like what you're saying about, like, you know, it's all of these different ways of measuring the same thing, like, you know. And I think that, you know, in chaos magic, we have like these, it's something called like the models of magic. The sort of thinking is that, look, you know, magic seems to work. We're not really sure why, But there's these different ideas about why it could be working. Like, it could be the psychological model. It could just be something about consciousness. Or I shouldn't say just, right? That's a very complicated topic. It could be something about, you know, energy. It could be something about, you know, actual spirits that exist or agents that exist in the world. It could be like a matrix thing, like you mentioned earlier, like a simulation thing. You know, some people say like it could be a combination or whatever. Like, but the point is like you can sort of choose which one of those things to look at depending on what you're looking at the time, whichever makes sense, and sort of still hold in the back of your mind that like you're not sure what's really going on behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess my last question for you would be, have you ever had an experience throughout your journey of occultism or esotericism that caused you to like maybe want to stop studying? If you're right, like an experience that maybe spooked you, like, oh, maybe I'm going too far.
I have had an experience, but it wasn't with my actual practice. It was with dealing with other humans. This has been something that has been with me for most of my life, right? So it's sort of like, yes, I've had some spooky things happen and stuff, but I've never like thought of just not. I don't know. There's been times when I haven't done much, when I haven't, like, you know, that there's been very non-magical periods of my life. I have background in science and stuff, but actually, to be honest, like, I came back to my love of magic, you know, through understanding how I could put it together with science, right? Like, when I could figure out, like, how to stitch these, like, sort of, like, disparate, like, ontological understandings I had of, like, you know, this esoteric shit and the scientific stuff. And so, yeah, when I found a sort of way of like looking at things that made that coalesce, that was super helpful. But yeah, in terms of like something that happened that was like, oh, fuck no, there's been times where I'm like, I'm never doing that particular thing again. Like that's happened plenty of times where it's like, nope, I'm not doing that. I've been there, done that. That's cool. Like not because it was like bad. It's just because it's like I learned what I needed to learn or like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes. Yes, absolutely. Like, I'm never going to do a full eighth of shrooms again at a party.
Yeah.
There's random little things like that, though. But
no need to, like.
No, I'm just kind of poking fun, but no, I know what you mean. Like, the shroom, like, whenever I do shrooms, for example, they kind of always give me the same, similar message now. And it's just kind of like, you've learned this already.
Sure. So. Yeah. And I think I think it's important to respect that stuff. Like, and yeah, I used to love doing that kind of stuff, and I sort of, you know, now maybe I would if I like really felt like the urge all of a sudden was like, oh, I got it, you know. But like, I for the most part, it's like, yeah, I sort of feel like I learned what I needed to, and I'm not opposed to it or anything like that. It's just not, I don't really have like a hankering for it or whatever.
Yeah. And I ask because it's interesting to see people on this journey of learning, you know, higher knowledge. Some people kind of just stop at certain points and turn around, or, you know, some people have come across, I've been accused of being like a Satanist, like all throughout my life. And it's just because of the things that I study. And it's just interesting to see some people.
Well, you wrote a book about Lucifer. So, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on what people mean by Satanist, right? I don't know. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's a bit suspicious. But no, it's just interesting to see how some people, because I've had moments in my studies and in my journey where certain things started to happen paranormally or psychologically, unsure about it, where I was kind of like, okay, maybe I'm venturing into like deep waters here. But I persevered and, like you said, try to just reposition the way I perceive it. And I just kept going, and I'm glad that I did, because you come out a stronger person spiritually.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think it's important, like, when you start feeling that happen, to like know that it's okay to take a break and get grounded again. And like, because I think, you know, when we're messing around with these kinds of practices, there can be the potential for, like, you know, these new sort of like altered states to occur. And until you sort of like acclimate yourself to that, it can be really destabilizing. So it's a good idea to do good self-care and be respectful of oneself. And as you said, like, also be disciplined and push forward when you're comfortable doing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, I have one more question for you. You mentioned that you had some cool esoteric hip hop. Are you comfortable sharing some of that with me so I can play it in this episode?
Oh, geez.
And if not, I'll totally cut this out. It's okay.
No, you can leave this section in there. It's just something that I've been hesitant to. I'm hesitant to share in my new endeavors.
Okay.
Just because I was so young when I was doing, you're younger than I am now when I was doing all the hip hop, and I've kind of just don't relate to that person anymore.
That's totally fair. I totally get that, dude.
See what I'm saying? But I still love it. I still love the writing process, and I love hip hop. That'll never die. But maybe. I'll give you an answer as quick as I can.
Okay, well, I'm super behind on production, so it's probably going to be forever before this comes out anyway, so you have some time to think about it.
All right,
dude, fuck yeah. Well, Eddie, thank you so much. Like, this has been a fucking really interesting conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you. Namaste.
Namaste. All right, fuck yeah, dude. Take care.
All right, peace.
All right, fuck yeah. Thanks again so much to Esoteric Eddie for taking the time to talk to me. Super interesting to hear all these different perspectives and sort of like how his ideas about Lucifer changed going through this research. Yeah, it's cool to hear from somebody that was coming from a little bit of a different frame of mind, I think, than I am usually when I'm looking at this stuff. So it's always cool to hear about that stuff. All right, so we talked about this right before the interview was over, and afterwards Eddie did reach out and let me know that there was a song that he would be comfortable with me playing some of here today. So let me go ahead and do that for you now. This is Orwellian, Enuma Elish.
Yo, I'm bombing for peace, and I'm fucking for virginity. It's all in duality, it's all in the symmetry. The way I pray for enemies, killing them generously. It's fancy the way that I ball and never feel jealousy. It don't get any motherfucking truer than this. Like the Hebrew text stemming from the Enuma Elish. Look within if you're seeking God and proof it exists. Cause it ain't no anything in the Babylonian suit of a fish. Creator gave us two of a fist. One to hold on, the other to pull you up as we move through the rift. So come now, and I'll show you what looms in the glitch. The artifact stolen and the room that it sits. The doom that inflicts from ignoring the damn water. For disrespecting knowledge, pouring out of Shambhala. You get dismembered, forgotten, and never thought of. Taken down faster than reporters when Skull and Bones is brought up. Homie, I'm holding my cross up. My heart is hidden like the Antarctic before it frosts up. We in the tech age, but look what it cost us. Look at the sun, boy, before you think that you're hot stuff. Yeah, motherfuckers. Yo, I'm bombing for peace, and I'm fucking for virginity. It's all in duality, it's all in the symmetry. The way I pray for enemies, killing them generously. It's fancy the way that I ball and never feel jealousy. Connecting with the creator when I'm rhyming in focus. Snorting lines wider than the writings of Orosius. Put me on the hell ride trying to cope with the connection between Akhenaten and Moses. Keep praying to heaven, kid, but it's just hopeless. Sumerian words mistranslated and quoted. I ain't trying to be the goat, trying to understand the secrets written by Eliphaz Levi of what the goat is. I ain't here for peace, trying to leave the system in pieces broken. Shattered and never again spoken. Eddie, Sumerian scribe, yo, I was chosen. The lines between the light and the dark are so dim. I chose my side, now I hide like a monk in a close friend. Moving swift, cause there ain't no fountain of you to soak in. Are you joking? This is our only chance to seek the celestial promotion. Yo, I'm bombing for peace, and I'm fucking for virginity. It's all in duality, it's all in the symmetry. The way I pray for enemies, killing them generously. It's fancy the way that I ball and never feel jealousy.
Alright, fuck yeah. Well, thank you so much to Esoteric Eddie for sharing that. He did indicate that this was, you know, written a little bit ago when he had a little bit of a different perspective. So that might be something that you noticed in the lyrics there. Very fun stuff, though, and I super appreciate him being willing to share. So don't miss the show notes for links to his stuff, as well as to links to Rachel's stuff, the Steel Mace Flow and all that good shit. Yes, there's going to be links in the show notes to all kinds of shit, so don't miss that. Also, don't miss all the great shows on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. We have Administrism, Ad Hoc History, Faith Blind Council, of course Lux Occult, Unearthing Paranormalcy, XV Planis, Primordia, Grognostics, Smuts Up, and I think I got everybody there. You can check the show notes for links to all of that stuff as well. All right, so let's return to the thought experiment from earlier regarding the experience machine. So you'll recall that this is a machine that you could get in. It's not unlike the Matrix. It's been pointed out to me by several people. Like, would you go be Neo in the Matrix if you could, but you'd have to forget that you were Neo in the Matrix, basically? I don't know. I'm sorry I brought the Matrix up. Apologies. But would you do this? Like, so Robert Nozick suggests that most people would not. And there is some evidence to suggest that this is like the intuitive reaction that is pretty widely shared. Like, most of us seem to have a sneaking suspicion that if we were doing something that turned out to be, quote, fake, it would like rob something from us. Like, if it, we were living in like a kind of Truman Show situation, it would denude something important in terms of like what our experience of our life would be. But like, the actual argument that emerges, like, from our consideration of the experience machine is noted usually to consist of being something about hedonism, right? Like, this is a sort of, like, idea of, like, well, is hedonism, like, does it play out in, like, a valid way? And this is, like, one sort of challenge to that. So, well, at least that's one interpretation of this. So I think that, you know, yeah, there's obviously a lot of people would say, like, no, I wouldn't want to do this. I'd want to have, like, the real thing or whatever. And a lot of people that I've talked to about this definitely did indicate that. Let's just define hedonism real quick. This is a definition from philosophicaldisquisitions.com, which is discussing this thought experiment. So, and you can find a link to that in the show notes. Hedonism is the view that the only thing that makes life good or bad for an individual is the extent to which that individual experiences pleasure and pain. Or to put it another way, is it the like view of the subjective experience of pleasure and pain are the ultimate bearers of value? And I think that like maybe we could put in a little bit of qualifiers here about pleasure and pain, like about like the technical, yeah, like, semantics are difficult here, but like this is probably good enough to be going on with. Like, is it a good or bad experience qualitatively? Like, is there anything other value other than like our own mental states, our own judgments of this? Hedonism can be contrasted with other theories of well-being, such as desire satisfaction theories or objective list theories. According to the former, desire satisfaction theories, what matters for the individual is that their desires are satisfied, even if those sometimes cause them like pleasure, pain, or suffering, or whatever. And according to the latter, which again was objective list theories, what matters there is whether the individual achieves or participates in certain objectively good states of affair. So Nozick claims that if hedonism is true, then we would all like be like, yeah, fuck yeah, experience machine, I'm jumping right in, right? And that would be the most logical and best thing for us because it would give us the best subjective experience. The fact that we don't think that this is the best thing for us, or at least most of us don't, provides some evidence against hedonism, or so it's thought. Some people suggest that we can boil down the argument that Nozick is making in this way. So, one, plugging into the experience machine would not be best for a person. Hedonism entails that plugging into the experience machine would be best, therefore hedonism is false. Okay, so would I go in? I don't know. I might. I'm not sure. I was talking about this with my partner and I asked, you know, him, and he said no, like, fuck no, actually. And I said maybe, you know, I'm not really so sure. And he asked me like a pretty interesting question then, and it was like, well, like, what would you be trying to get out of this experience machine that you don't think that you could get out of your actual life? So that's kind of an interesting, I don't know, yeah, an interesting way to look at it, right? Like, if you could have an experience machine, what would you program it to do, turn that around, and whatever. So when we consider the like I don't know, the efficacy of magic. Like, to what extent could the argument be made that this isn't to some extent the case? I don't know. There's a lot of like schools of thought that think that, yes, we're, you know, come from somewhere else and we choose this life that we're going to live and we, you know, decide we're going to go do this task or whatever, like this life's work, or like, this is kind of like, in some ways, like, is that the same way as like plugging into an experience machine too? Like, I'm not sure. But if you have thoughts, I would be very curious to hear them. You can reach me at lexocultpod@gmail.com or at lexocultpod on Instagram. And you can tell me about how unpopular my opinion about the experience machine is, because people do not seem to like it. Another question that I have is going back to the discussion of qualia that we were talking about earlier. And my question here is, like, who gets to have qualia, right? If it's like a property of consciousness, where do we cut it off, right? Like, there's a lot of thinking that consciousness is something that kind of pervades, is sort of like a pervasive feature of the universe or perhaps of matter or whatever, rather than something that only emerges out of complexity, something that emerges in a lot of different levels out of, you know, in different layers of complexity. So I'm curious, like, where do we cut that off? Like, if we were kind of going with that way of thinking about that stuff, like, we could certainly make the argument somewhat easily about the eye and the camera that both were experiencing qualia. I don't know. Maybe I'm just, like, struggling my best to try to return to my comfort zone of functionalism. Unclear. But again, I'd love to hear people's thoughts about all this stuff. And if you're into the show and you're into what I'm doing here, you can support it on Patreon. People who do so can take a bibliomancy break with me. And there are no tiers or levels, so give as you will. And I super appreciate everybody who is already doing that. Your support is really important and it really means a lot, so thank you so, so much. Okay, so a couple quick things about failure. I found something that tied in pretty well with these like themes of these different machines. We've got the universe machine, the experience machine. Anyway, so this is regarding failure. And fear also. I've been thinking a lot about fear as well. And so failure is something that I do think that I've had a big fear of in the past, and I still do. This is a very common thing, right? You know, but failure is something that we learn from, right? It's an important learning thing. And I think that that fear of failure was certainly holding me back and probably continues to do so. So that's something I can keep working on. And I was thinking about this, okay, well, how do you do that? Well, you fail on purpose. And so I typed failing on purpose into a search and I came up with an article from a blog called The Emotion Machine, which fit in really well with all this, I thought. So this is some of what the author has to say here. So Thomas Watson, the former president of IBM, once said that if you want to succeed, double your failure rate. This quote has always stuck with me. It sounds like we should actively try to fail more often, which seems counterintuitive. However, the more I thought about it, the more it began to make sense. Trying to fail on purpose teaches us a lot of valuable lessons, like it lets you know that you're going out of your comfort zone and trying new things. It teaches you what your current limitations are and what you need to work on to improve. And it can show you that failure isn't as horrible as you imagined. The more you embrace failure, the more you become desensitized to it. Most of the failure that we fear in our lives is pretty inconsequential. The world is not going to end. You're just going to maybe feel a little temporary pain and embarrassment. However, by the end of the day, you're probably going to feel better by putting yourself out there. The pain of trying and failing is much smaller than the pain of never trying at all. My recommendation to you, he says, try putting yourself in more situations where you know you're going to fail. Don't put yourself in any situation that's too serious or life-threatening, thanks, but also put yourself in extreme situations where the likelihood of you succeeding is small. He gives an example then about going to a batting cage and trying to hit balls at a speed which was like much higher than his skill level and doing a really shitty job but still having fun. And exposing yourself to more difficult situations heightens your threshold for success so that when you go back to other easier tasks, it makes them seem much more doable. So don't be afraid of failure in your life. Do the opposite, actively embrace it and find situations where you know there's a good chance you'll fail. That's one of the best ways you're going to test your limits and keep on a constant path of self-improvement. So thank you to Steve Handel for writing that. I'm experimenting it with it right now by not writing a script for this portion of the show. I think this will save me some time if I can stop obsessively writing scripts that I don't even read all of. Anyway, I do like experimental design, so I do want to just point out real quick something about the little article that I just read and about increasing your failure rate. This would only work in cases where the new iteration of what you were trying was novel. Like, this is not going to help you. Like, increasing, like, your rate of failure is not going to help you if you're trying the same thing over and over again the same way. Just had to put that out there. Okay. Thinking a little bit more about words and their meanings, I've been thinking also about the relationship between the two words optimistic and optimization, and the relationship between, you know, having an optimistic attitude being optimal for one's mental health. Optimism isn't always rational, which is something that's interesting. There's an interesting tightrope walk to be walked there. It's almost like a controlled delusion in some ways. I'll think more about that. I'm not sure I like that verbiage. That's okay. Another thing I've been wondering about too, and this will probably expose a lot of my ignorance in terms of some of the more nuanced thought regarding Christianity and all of the many things at play there. But I want to go back and sort of like bookend what we started the show with, which was a quote from the Bible. This is Isaiah 14, 12 through 14 from the King James Version. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation, in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Okay, so there's this idea of, like, he wanted to be like God, and that's what fucked him up. But, like, there's also a lot of messages, like, in the tradition about trying to, like, be like, and I guess Jesus isn't, and God, there's the whole idea of the Trinity, which is still confusing to me. Again, that's okay. I'm working through it. Just curious anyway. But, like, so there's this idea of, like, wanting to be like the Most High and that being the thing that fucks you up. But, like, it's also, like, the idea that, like, as humans, like, we are sort of creators. Like, we can't help it. We just make things. Like, that's just what we do. And so in some ways, like, we're little iterations of this creator God. This is a very common idea. So, like, is this a sort of, like, double bind, right? Like, you know, there's this idea that, and I think I mentioned this in the interview, that, like, when we ate the apple in the garden, like, this is when we became actual humans. Like, is that Luciferian quest of creation, of being like the Most High, like our defining characteristic? Are we in this sort of like double bind? Also, there's like this interesting relationship between Jesus and Lucifer. I know this comes up a lot of different places. Jesus himself is this sort of like Luciferian character who challenges authority and who wants to bring down this corrupt system. And, like, you know, you can look at him that way. There's a lot of different ways of looking at it, right? I just think it's interesting. Like, we find all of these mixed messages, and mixed messages come from all different places, and this is just one of them. But I don't know. Thinking about mixed messages, and I'm thinking about, like, Pavlovian conditioning and stuff, and when the dogs were subjected to, like, different treatment regimes, like, they got different instructions at different times of day, and, you know, things got all messed up and chaotic, it made them go crazy. Like, it made them lose their shit. And I just wonder to what extent there's this sort of psychic warfare happening all the time, just in terms of that very basic thing about mixed messages. Unclear, but interesting stuff to consider. All right, on a happier note, I'm really looking forward to the moon ritual that we are getting ready to run with the Green Mushroom Project. Should the stars and the new moon align properly, this episode will be coming out as we do that. So, knock on wood, hopefully that will happen. And if not, it'll come out when it's ready, and that'll be all right, too. Anyway, I just really appreciate everybody listening. Thank you so much. much love to everybody participating in the Green Mushroom Project, no matter what that's looking like for you in your individual practice. Keep an eye out for those mixed messages and do a little bit of analysis about what they're actually trying to tell you below the surface. Remember to resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. All right, fuck yeah. Thank you so much to Eddie and to Rachel for coming on and talking to me. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to stay strong and stay fucking curious.
Lux Occult is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. To hear more great independent productions like the one you just listened to, visit our catalog at pgnpodcastnetwork.com.
So what's up? It's a sex-positive comedy show your parents forgot to warn you about.
I will be your delightful host, Deep Weird, and with me are my three very sexy friends.
I'm Captain Spanx, drop an anchor, it's a spanker!
Hi, I'm Raven Gunnigan, and I'm about to eat 16 feet of nerd rope.
And I'm Luxa, and that is all you get to know about me. Join us for a ride full of twists and turns as we explore the rabbit hole that is human sexuality.
I, Smuts Up Crew, would like to propose...
Oh my god, he's proposing.
A question.
Get down on your fucking knees. If you're curious about expanding your horizons or getting more comfortable in your own skin, then the Smuts Up Podcast is for you. Or maybe you're just a horny nerd or a person who enjoys outdated references. The Smuts Up Podcast is fun for the whole step family.
I'm going to say the B word. Butthole sunning.
If you were to put a hot dog in it, is it a sandwich?
I don't know. Is a bread dildor with a hot dog inside it a sandwich? Write to us at smutsup69@gmail.com and let us know what you think about that. Available on your favorite podcast apps.
I put a D20 in my mouth.
Welcome to XP Planners. Greetings, friends, fiends, and lovers of strange and wondrous things. My name is Flood, and I am the host of XV Planets, a bi-weekly podcast of the odd and unusual. The core of XV Planets is a documentary-style exploration into paranormal investigations that I and my ever-evolving group of magical misfits conduct. We take a look at the history, the mystery, then go see it for ourselves, and then we bring that experience, and on occasion, that evidence, to your ears. Alongside the investigations, you'll find a treasure trove of other content, like interviews with authors, art historians, mediums, UFO researchers, cryptid hunters, fellow paranormal investigators, as well as deep dives into the arts, exploring topics like the Killing Joke frontman Jazz Coleman's magical practices and how that propelled the band forward, and whether or not David Lynch was really conducting occult rituals through Twin Peaks: The Return. So follow XV Planets today and get caught up on the journey, because I can promise you, it only gets stranger from here. I'll see you on the fifth plane.